From feature story news in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Simon Marks. Today, a special edition of the program that looks at the crisis in global education and one man's proposals for fixing it. Salman Khan is one of the most prominent and controversial voices in the debate over how to improve grades here in the US and overseas.
I think the state will always play a very strong role. I think public education is a very, very powerful thing. Our role is to show where, without extra money, with the resources on hand, you're able to move the dial.
His Khan Academy on YouTube has already taught millions, but now he's calling for the creation of a one-world schoolhouse. And you'll hear about his ideas and the people who disagree with him, coming up on FSN Reports. But first, our summary of the day's main news.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster with a review of 2013 and a look ahead at what's to come in 2014, both in the U.S. and internationally. With President Obama in his second term, he may have hoped for a bit of smooth sailing, but this year was full of turbulence. International relations were thrown off course by the revelations of former U.S. National Security Agency contractor Edward Snowden. The whistleblower fled the U.S., ending up in Russia, after leaking information on U.S. intelligence programs, including the mass collection of civilian cell phone and internet data. There was international outcry from many countries. Internet giants like Google and Facebook also got into the act, speaking out against the government co-opting their data. The leaks have prompted a global dialogue on the line between respecting civilian privacy and ensuring national security. Speaking to The Guardian in Snowden's own words.
America is a fundamentally good country. We have good people with good values who want to do the right thing. But the structures of power that exist are working to their own ends to extend their capability at the expense of the freedom of all publics.
Another crisis came in Syria, with accusations that the Assad regime used chemical weapons on its own citizens. President Obama said the time had come for action, but his military strike proposal proved unpopular. Instead, Russian President Vladimir Putin called for Syria to turn their chemical weapons over to the international community. And the U.S. president also faced a number of issues on the home front, the biggest among which may have been the botched rollout of his Affordable Care Act, commonly known as Obamacare.
That's on me. We fumbled the rollout on this health care law.
The president's health care reform hit a number of setbacks, and Americans grew frustrated. And Republicans said the issues were just proof that the plan was doomed from the start. Dysfunction in Washington also came to a head with a government shutdown, when Congress missed the deadline to decide on a budget deal.
There's only one way out of this reckless and damaging shutdown. Pass a budget that funds our government, with no partisan strings attached. Take that vote. Stop this farce. End this shutdown now.
Republicans refused to support any deal that didn't eliminate Obamacare, and the standoff lasted nearly 3 weeks, with furloughed workers and tourists paying the price. And the U.S. faced tragedy in April when a pair of brothers set off bombs at the famed Boston Marathon. Chaos broke out, leaving 3 dead and over 250 people injured. But the U.S. wasn't the only country with troubles. Kenya grieved over its own terror in September, when Islamist militants took over a shopping mall in Nairobi, taking civilians hostage. The ensuing gun battle left over 70 dead. But the year also had its share of good tidings. The world turned its eyes to London with the birth of William and Kate's first child, Prince George. FSN's Catherine Drew has more.
The young prince becomes the third in line to the British throne, and his arrival prompted intense international media interest and public celebrations.
Looking forward to the next baby as well, because again, a young couple, madly in love, and this is the time to have your babies.
And after Pope Benedict XVI's surprise resignation, the conclave elected its first non-European leader in Pope Francis, known as the Humble Pope. Pope Francis has won the love of many for his comparatively liberal views and desire to reform the papacy, emphasizing compassion for those from all walks of life. But as the year came to a close, the world came together in mourning the loss of revolutionary South African leader Nelson Mandela, credited as the driving force in ending racial apartheid. His longtime ally, Archbishop Desmond Tutu.
Like a most precious diamond, he was virtually flawless.
These and many more events happened in 2013, and 2014 looks to bring its fair share of action. The global debate over intelligence gathering is set to continue, with no end in sight for Snowden's leaks, and America's international alliances growing increasingly strained. U.S. congressional elections are also around the corner. The government shutdown reflected poorly on Republicans, but the issues with Obamacare also hurt Democrats. And pundits question whether they can wrestle the House back from the conservatives. And here's FSN's Tom Barton on the controversy surrounding the upcoming Winter Olympics in Sochi.
Putin himself has had to upbraid local officials for massive alleged corruption. The Games are already the most expensive in world history, and there have been calls for boycotts and protests at Sochi to protest Russia's treatment of gay rights.
And that's 2013 in review. From Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Simon Marks. Welcome to FSN Reports. Today, a special edition of the program in which you'll hear some pugnacious and controversial thoughts about the future of children's education. They come from Salman Khan, author of a book called The One World Schoolhouse and founder of the online Khan Academy. 37 years old, he's a Bangladeshi American who quit his day job as a hedge fund manager and became a YouTube sensation.
You know, literally in 2004, I had just gotten married, and I had some family visiting me after the wedding in Boston. And in particular, I had my 12-year-old cousin Nadia visiting, and incredibly bright. I was really impressed with her. It was actually the first time that I had interacted with her as an adult. And while we were meeting, I actually told her mom, I was like, you know, Nadia's showing a lot of potential. I think she could really do some amazing things. And her mom said, well, that's really nice, and they view you as it's kind of an older brother figure, but Nadia's actually having trouble with math. So I offered to tutor her remotely. So she was based in New Orleans, which is where I grew up. And so she agreed that when she would go back, every day after work for me and after school for her, we would do a remote tutoring session. And so we started doing that. Long story short, in about 2 months, she had kind of gotten over that hurdle and actually gotten ahead of her grade level. And everything was working out. Then I started tutoring her younger brothers remotely. And then about 18 months later, word had gotten around to the family that some free tutoring was going on. So I was tutoring on the order of 10 or so cousins and family members every day after work. And I actually already started writing a little piece of software to give them practice problems. And so I, as their tutor, could keep track of what they were doing. And a friend said, oh, this is really cool software, but, you know, I was telling him how I was having trouble scaling myself with the actual live tutorials. And he suggested, well, why don't you make some videos and put them up on YouTube? And I thought that was a silly idea. I said, you know, YouTube's for cats playing piano, not for serious mathematics. But I got over the idea. It wasn't mine. And I gave it a shot. And that was 2006. November 2006 was the first video I uploaded. And I now famously, my cousin's first point of feedback was that they liked me better on YouTube than in person. And I kept going. And before long, it became obvious that people who were not my cousins were watching the videos, and they started to send letters, and my wife will tell you I'm a sucker for positive feedback. So I kept going, and by 2009, had set it up as a not-for-profit, and I just had trouble focusing on my day job, and so sat down with my wife, and we figured that we had enough savings for about a year to try to start this not-for-profit thing called the Khan Academy, or it had already started, but to commit myself to it full time.
But that's an incredibly bold leap, isn't it? A hedge fund manager throwing it all up and saying, I'm actually going to put my future on YouTube.
I think it started off from a place where I never viewed this as a business. And frankly, I still don't view this as a business because it's not a business. I just viewed it as a really fun hobby. I had this day job working as an analyst at a hedge fund. I was doing just fine. And then I got to come home and get these nice thank you letters and go into some math and science that I liked talking about or researching or teaching. And it really just, that started to overtake my life. So I had to just introspect what was really making me happy. And I kind of determined that if I could do whatever this Khan Academy thing was becoming, if I could do that full time and get a professor salary, that would be worth more to me than becoming a big hedge fund manager.
You said that at the time, YouTube was really known for being the website of teenagers dancing in their bedrooms and skateboarding cats. you actually played a role in changing the reputation of the YouTube brand.
I wasn't the first person to ever put educational videos on YouTube. I think what's unique about Khan Academy, or at least those first videos that I had done, is that they had gotten broad traction. And I don't think people had seen something like that before. And I think that helped the public perception of YouTube to be perceived as not just a place for silly, fun videos, but also a place where you could learn something.
And then this thing rapidly scaled.
Yeah, it's like you learn about exponential growth in school, and when you're growing from 10 to 13 people in a month, it doesn't seem that crazy that you grew 30% in a month. But when you grow from 100,000 to 130,000 people in a month, or 1 million to 1.3 million people in a month, then you start to realize what exponential growth is.
And so where are you now in terms of the number of videos you've produced, the number of people watching, the number of countries that are utilizing the Khan Academy's materials?
So right now, it's well over 3,000 videos. They've been watched over 180 million times. The breakdown has been 60% North America, 40% rest of the world. It's as far as we can tell, every country that has internet access that hasn't blocked us, and a few have. I think blocked us as part of YouTube. I don't think they have anything against us.
Those controversial math classes.
Those controversial math classes and science classes. And in terms of what we are, and this is one thing I want to emphasize, is that we definitely, the videos were what got the most notoriety and definitely are still a big part of what we are, but most of the resources we're now spending on Khan Academy are around the interactive portions of it in terms of the problem sets that students can do. They get feedback. There's dashboards for parents and teachers and students. And we just launched a computer science portion of our site, which is a very interactive way to learn computer science.
So I want to ask you about that, because the point came where you realized that this was about more than simply putting instructional videos up on the internet for people to use.
I've always had ambitions from when I was in college all the way through my career. I was like, I think software could do something to help people learn. And I wasn't the first person to think that. There have been many attempts to create software to help people learn. And so I viewed my cousins as almost guinea pigs. I could see if they could learn through software. And then the videos were just a supplement to that. So the idea of using interactive software is kind of predates the videos. But then once we got a lot of notoriety and there were people who came out of the woodwork and said, oh, we'd like to fund you. What do you think Khan Academy could be? That's where I said, look, I think the videos are great and we can translate them into many, many languages, and we are right now. But I don't think that's a complete offering. I think we need to supplement that, or they should be the supplement to interactive problem sets. We should have explorations, we should have data, we should have tools for teachers so they could use this, ways that this could complement a physical classroom. And so that's what most of our resources are being spent on.
So when you think about the educational establishment, I mean, schools, institutions of learning, universities, they have large staffs that produce coursework and deal with students on a continuing basis. What have you got?
We're 35 people right now. On the content side, I still produce videos, and I do other things here in the organization. We have two art historians making art history videos, and then we have two other, I would call them closer to being real film producers. They do more edited, more highly produced videos. I'm still making math and science videos. And then the rest of our team is mainly software engineers, teachers, education researchers who are helping interface with the outside world, seeing what we can learn from best practices that are happening out there and research and bringing it into the product.
So when you produce a video, for example, on molecular chemistry, I mean, I understand that Sal Khan knows how to do basic math, but what do you know about molecular chemistry? How are you in a position to create that video and put it up there?
Yes, so that's the fun thing, and the challenging thing for me individually is, yes, there's some things that by virtue of my background I know reasonably well. There's other things I've always wanted to know better. This is motivation for me to get better at it. So for example, if I'm doing biochemistry, you know, I know it reasonably well, but in order to teach it, you have to learn it at a much deeper level. I will immerse myself in that subject. And then once I feel like it's really distilled in my brain and I understand it as intuitively as I understand math or physics or anything else like that, I'll make the video. And the really powerful thing is that we have kind of the whole world being our editorial. Once I put up a video, we have, within a day, we'll have several thousand people view it. And some are students looking to learn it, but many of them are teachers, professors, graduate students looking to maybe use it or even critique it. Sometimes they're not always friends of ours, but they'll critique it and we'll take those very seriously and we'll say, oh, is that a legitimate critique? Oh, it is. Maybe we should make another video clarifying something. Maybe we should redo the video. So we do that quite often. We're always looking at what people are saying.
I want to talk more about the critique in a second, but first of all, explain a little bit more about your philosophy of education, because as you've developed this system, you have thought arguably as deeply as anybody else in this country about educational philosophy, and you don't see successful education as in a classic top-down professor behind a desk giving a lecture to a group of students who are all sitting in a classroom listening and soaking it in and then learn to regurgitate it by rote.
That's exactly right. I don't think that the traditional lecture model is the ideal use of either a professor or teacher's time. I actually think real learning always takes place when the student decides to learn. And what I believe strongly is people should be able to learn at their own pace. They should be able to get a solid grounding in basic subjects before they're forced to move on. Right now what you're happening is, we see happening especially in math and science, but I think across other subjects, is people have a weak understanding of exponents. They're given a grade, maybe a B or a C, and then they're moved on to the next topic, which builds on that. It might be logarithms or negative exponents. And somehow the current system expects that student to now be able to understand something more complicated, even though the assessment already showed they didn't understand the more basic thing. So what we say is instead of holding fixed when you have to learn something and how long you have to learn something, and the variable is how well you learn it, and that's usually a grade, we say let's go the other way around. Let's let someone learn at their own pace. The variable is how long they have to learn something and when they learn it, and what's fixed is that they have a high level of mastery. And if they have a high level of mastery, they have all their gaps filled, then when they go to the next topic, the more advanced topic, it'll seem almost intuitive. And in terms of the virtual and physical, we think that when people are in a physical environment together, they should be interacting with each other. They should be teaching each other, talking to each other, building things, working on projects. And so right now you have lecture halls where it's a passive environment. Students are listening, taking notes. A teacher is giving a lecture that they might have given many times before. We think a lot of that stuff can happen at a student's own pace. And when they go to the lecture hall, or it won't be a lecture hall anymore, they can do peer-to-peer interaction, they can tutor each other, they can tackle hard problems together, and they'll have the teacher there to actually interact with them, to answer their questions and mentor them.
You said there it won't be a lecture hall anymore. I mean, that is a radical rethinking of the way the educational establishment works.
Yeah, you know, it's both radical and not so radical. You know, throughout, I mean, the last 100 years, there have been examples of this. If you go to some of the top business schools in the world, they have a case method, which is essentially that students do their reading and preparation at their own time, and when they come together, they do not have a lecture, they have a conversation. And in a lot of the humanities classes, this has been standard practice, where students do some reading, they do some research at their own time, and when they come together, they don't get a lecture, they have a conversation, they have a seminar. And so there's no reason why this can't be naturally extended to everything. Because the information delivery that traditionally happens in lecture, we now think can happen in better ways outside of the lecture hall. And now the lecture, or what used to be the lecture hall, this physical experience, can now move up the value chain. But to what you're saying, I guess it could also be viewed as radical, because right now a disproportionate amount of class time is that traditional lecture.
Well, there are clearly some people out there who view this as threatening. I'm sure you're familiar with a blog post that appeared on the Chronicle of Higher Education website, which said, Khan Academy is great for learning about lots of different subjects. That's nice. But it's not really adequate for learning those subjects on a level that makes a difference in the world. Not so nice.
Yeah, well, you know, that second part is a tough question, I think, for education generally. You know, when we're put Khan Academy aside, when kids are in physics class or calculus class, how many of them are translating that to their everyday life, or, you know, or they're in biology class or whatever? And I think this is a question that Khan Academy and everyone across the education spectrum has to ask themselves. Are these translatable skills? Are these skills that are meaningful for students? With that said, we don't think we're by any means perfect, and we're just the very early stages of what we're doing. But I think, you know, the students and teachers that are using them, they are definitely getting value out of it. I mean, you know, this is the 5 million students and the 10,000 teachers who are using it. No one's telling them to. No one's forcing them to. And so we kind of look to them and say, where are you finding value in the Khan Academy, and where can we improve? But, you know, to that point, we don't think it's a solved problem, but I think what we're going to try to do over the next year, 5 years, 10 years, hopefully 100 years, is just keep improving, keep iterating, so we can strive after that goal.
So there's another criticism out there that says simply doing a lecture on video isn't all that innovative. I presume you would say, well, we're not simply doing a lecture on video.
First, I would agree with that statement. Simply doing a lecture on video is not that innovative. So just on the video side, what's new here is that here's a collection that has gotten traction, that students and teachers and parents are finding valuable at a scale, and by no means is it perfect. There's a lot of work we can do. But then the second part I would say is I agree as well that video alone isn't the whole thing, and that's why most of our resources are on the interactive side, having students do problems, having them do explorations. And then on top of that, we're even exploring physical programs like summer schools, and we're working with physical schools themselves so that we can say, look, how do we create a holistic experience for these students?
Well, that goes to another criticism. Some critics have said rather than revolutionizing mathematics teaching and learning, the Khan Academy's work adds a technological patina to a moribund notion of teaching and learning mathematics. In other words, they're essentially accusing you of standing up a broken system rather than dismantling it and changing it.
I actually think some of this criticism comes from misunderstanding what we are trying to do. If you see these video lectures and if you see these online exercises, you might think, oh, these people think that's education. No, we think that's a tool for education. That's a tool for enabling the physical experience to become more project-based, to do real hands-on things. And I think once you do that, I think actually a lot of these critics are the ones that believe strongly in hands-on learning, who believe in explorative learning, who believe that students should struggle with real hard problems and have their professors there to mentor them as opposed to lecture them. So I think we're on the same page, and sometimes we're just misperceived a little bit.
Now, you're a young organization. Does that mean that at some point soon you will have metrics that prove the success or failure of the system?
We've been talking with hundreds of teachers in schools about how they can use it. And we've been doing studies. And so we've been partnering with organizations to measure pre-test, post-test, how are these students doing. There's actually a tremendous blog post from what happened in Oakland Unity. The students improved fairly dramatically. And ours is, these tests we don't view as a thumbs up or thumbs down. We view it as, where does this work and where does this not work? Or what are the practices where this tool is being used in a positive way and it's definitely moving the dial? What are the practices where maybe it's not happening as much? And how can we get those practices to look more like the ones that are working? So for us, it's much more of, we care a lot about the data and we are seeing pretty good improvement. But for us, it's not a thumbs up or thumbs down. It's how do we iterate? How do we improve? How do we share best practices? Even the ones where we are seeing results, how do we improve those results even more? How do we get the students more engaged? How do we get them further up their learning curve?
Are there any parents out there that worry about their kids being guinea pigs?
There's been a lot of transparency with parents. But if anything, we've gone the other way. It's that there's actually been demand from parents who aren't part of the program. They've been kind of clamoring more for it than the other way around.
If you look at the statistics concerning education in the United States, it is apparent action has to be taken. American students rank 25th in math and 21st in science compared to the students in 30 industrialized countries. More than 1.2 million students drop out of school every year. Looking broadly at the educational panorama here, how critical is change needed?
Well, it's huge. I mean, education is the core of everything. And I'll even, and obviously the U.S. has issues being pretty far down the list, especially of wealthy countries in terms of how students are performing. But I actually think it's a global thing. I think even in the top performing countries, they have far too many students who are struggling with math, struggling with science. I mean, in the U.S., it's at the level where at a lot of four-year universities, a majority of students are having to take essentially pre-algebra or having to take middle school math, which shows that they didn't actually get a lot out of what they were exposed to later on in their careers. So, but I think it's universal. I mean, I think you go even some of the top-performing countries, whether it's Korea or Finland or whatever, and you'll see tons of students falling through the cracks. And so we hope to help all of these students globally not fall.
But can the United States turn around what is becoming, in educational terms, a real competitive disadvantage when it looks particularly toward Asia and it sees developments in China and the rising of India and other nations in other parts of the world? Is this something that can, at this point, be turned around?
I don't know. I don't know what kind of there's a system out there. And the one thing we're careful is I don't want to be viewed as like an ed reformer who's going there with a stick and trying to somehow reform the system. I don't know if that's possible. I don't know how it can be done. Obviously, it becomes very political and other people better equipped are trying to fight that fight in ways that they see fit. Our goal is to, let's see what we can do with these tools. Let's make the case that these tools are very accessible and anyone can do them as long as there's a will to use them. And then hopefully the change will happen from the ground up. And frankly, that is what we are at least starting to see. You know, one thing that I and our team is very careful, we've had ministers of education come to us and governors and say, oh, I want to mandate this in our state. And I was like, no, don't mandate anything. Because as soon as you mandate it, it can be broken and it can be implemented badly. Any tool, a piece of chalk can be used well or it can be used badly. And at this stage, we did not want this type of thing. Actually, at any stage, what we want is the other way. We want it to be pulled. We want students and parents and individual teachers, the ones that are actively kind of on the ground, to say, you know, this is a pretty valuable tool. And I, you know, most all, or if not all teachers, all students, all parents want the student to learn. And so if they see something happening, if their neighbor is doing something and that student is, you know, getting ahead, or if it helped them out with their grades, that word of mouth, I think, is the strongest way to change things. And that's what we've been kind of, you know, our growth of the 5 million users, it's not a government telling someone you have to use Khan Academy. It's not, it's people telling each other, hey, this worked for my neighbor, or this worked for my son, you might want to try it.
Right, but if a private initiative, ultimately, I know it's run as a non-for-profit, but ultimately this is a private initiative.
Non-governmental,
Can engage in that kind of activity. Is there a point at which there's a debate to be had about the role someone like you plays in educating children versus the role traditionally played by the state?
That's something I have no real opinion about. I mean, I have an opinion of, but to put simply, I think the state will always play a very strong role. I think public education is a very, very powerful thing. I think our role is to show cases where without extra money, with the resources on hand, you're able to move the dial. And if we can show that, and we can show it across use cases, whether it's affluent neighborhoods, underserved neighborhoods, different demographics, different geographies, then I think we will have done our part. And then other people say, well, it's just a matter of do you adopt it or do you not? And especially if we lower all of the barriers to adoption. But yeah, I don't think, you know, it's already getting a little political, us giving away free videos, educational videos. I definitely don't think it's even our place to go and say, this is the way public school should be, or this is how it should be funded, or anything like that.
And you view all this in a transnational fashion. I mean, you've spoken about creating the global One World Classroom. Your book is going to be called The One World Schoolhouse. This isn't just about lifting educational standards in one country.
Yeah, well, absolutely. I mean, you know, right now our content is primarily in English, but it's already being used around the world. We're doing translations into Spanish, Portuguese, Mandarin, Hindi, Bengali, the top 10 languages of the world, and then we're going to go from there. Our goal over the next year is to localize the site so it's available in all of the world's languages. We've talked to people about how can we introduce more content on the site that could be regional specific, maybe if you want to learn a specific skill in a particular part of the world. So we really want to view this as like an institution for the world so that hopefully in 50 years, access to a world-class education will be like clean drinking water. It'll be, you know, it's not why, it'll be why not. And it'll be ridiculously inexpensive to deliver it to someone in a village that right now has no access to anything. So that is the goal. And I actually think it'll help everybody if we can get there.
Can he get there? Can Salman Khan genuinely create the One World Schoolhouse of his dreams? With Silicon Valley's track record of success and the wind of the information superhighway at his back, he at least thinks he's in with a chance. That's our special Christmas Day edition of FSN Reports. Tomorrow, what role will Russia play globally in 2014? We'll have an extended discussion with the team in the FSN Moscow Bureau. I'm Simon Marks. For everyone with FSN everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.